Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Scott Turow's latest novel is Presumed Guilty, a sequel to Presumed Innocent, the number one bestseller that redefined the legal thriller and is the basis for Apple TV Plus's most watched drama series ever. Scott Turow, a writer and former practicing lawyer, is the author of 13 best-selling works of fiction, including Presumed Innocent and Suspect. His latest is Presumed Guilty, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Scott Turow to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. What an honor to have you back on the program.
Good to be with you, and you know, I appreciate being with you again.
I so enjoyed this novel, and I'm interested in at what point you started to think about writing about this stage of Rusty's life, who was the main character of Presumed Innocent.
I think I had it in mind probably since I published the second novel in this trilogy, Innocent, 15 years ago, that I was probably going to go back to Rusty one more time. You know, I thought I left him in a pretty unsettled state at the end of Innocent, and that if nothing else, I was curious to see what would become of him, given, you know, where he was at that point. He had been just released from prison, was heading north to a family cabin, and clearly was interested in cutting most of his ties in the place he lived all his life, which is my fictional Kendall County. So I thought, well, I got to see what happens.
And as far as seeing what happens, as this novel starts, he's in a pretty good place in his life. He has a fiance. He seems to have become a part of the community, and things are fairly calm.
Certainly, he seems willing to say, and I think an observer would also say that he's in a more settled part of his life than he's ever been before. He feels that B, the local grade school principal with whom he's living and is now engaged to, is the woman that he, as he puts it, he should have been dreaming of always. You know, he's content in that relationship, probably more content than he's ever been in a personal relationship. He likes the work he's doing. He's working, as many former judges do, as an arbitrator and a mediator. And he feels comfortably ingrained in this rural community that's sort of half a resort community, half a farming community. And he's beginning to understand its terms and is pleased with that as well.
And as the story starts to take place, and the woman who is his fiance, her son is in trouble, and he starts to navigate those waters. And because the son is black, it is to look at that community and that area through that lens, in which allows him to learn even more about this area that he has become a resident of.
Right. I mean, B, long before her relationship with Rusty, she and her ex-husband adopted Aaron through a connection to her college roommate. Aaron is, you know, in the common parlance of Americans, black, although the percentage of his ancestry that's purely African is unclear from looking at him. But he's in an area where there are not a lot of African Americans. And that allows Aaron, or causes Aaron, to grow up feeling somewhat estranged, even though everybody in his family unquestionably loves him. I got a really interesting email yesterday from a woman who's the grandmother of a kid who grew up in the same situation. And what she basically said is, you know, I never really understood before why my grandson is so much to himself until I realized he's just like Aaron.
Mm. And that so much to himself is finding a place in this community and even finding a place within the family unit, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, B at points talks about the pain of being a parent who has to teach this child from an early age. There are ways in which you are not like me, and I am not like you. And we both have to figure out how to deal with that and be at peace with that. And that's, you know, although every parent quickly realizes that, you know, their children each are individuals, it's rarely that explicit that a parent has to say, there's something about you that I can't share. And you know, and she, as I said, she finds that a source of some anguish, and yet she knows it's true.
You mentioned this, but these are two people who at the beginning of the novel feel that they're so right for each other. They're ready to get married. They're ready for the next step and you know, their act three or act four of their lives. And they're feeling pretty good about that. And we also, we learn and we're reminded, if we didn't know already, how quickly things can turn.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a sad lesson of relationships. Things can go sour in some cases pretty fast. Aaron has been convicted of a drug offense and he is living with them as a condition of his probation. And Rusty has absolutely no enthusiasm for taking that on. And yet he says, you know, at that point approaching, well, he's in his early 70s, he says he knows better than to try to come between a mother and her child. That's never going to work out. So he agrees to take Aaron under his roof in the hopes that it will be a temporary arrangement. And they're close to the end of Aaron's probation when the events of the novel unfold, which find Aaron suddenly disappearing, going dark, as you might put it, completely incommunicado, which the terms of his probation absolutely prohibit.
And it's interesting in those sections of the book of how B relates to it versus how Rusty relates to it, because Rusty is maybe even a stepfather figure at that and certainly understands B's take, but also is looking at it very much as an attorney and as someone who, what troubles lie ahead as a result of those actions.
Yeah, well, I mean, Rusty has many different layers in looking at Aaron's disappearance and his disobedience. One vantage is pretty selfish. He still needs his license to practice law in order to continue with his career as an arbitrator. And generally speaking, if you defy a judge's orders, that's not good for the future of your law license. So, but you know, more than that, he's concerned about the impact of Aaron's troubles on his relationship with B. And your reference, Joe, to things going sour fast is really founded in that reality that, you know,
right.
The old saying, if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. You know, if she's grieving over this child, it's an open question as to whether even a pretty contented relationship will be able to sustain her.
And it's both that love that brings that feeling, but also that he wants to help and to take on Aaron's case, and that's tough for all the reasons you just mentioned, because he's wide-eyed to that. That's not like it's a sudden realization. He knows that from the very beginning.
Right. Rusty ultimately, after objecting pretty strongly, agrees to represent Aaron when he's charged with first-degree murder for murdering the young woman with whom he disappeared. And, you know, Rusty just starts out with, first of all, technically, he's not a family member, but he's about to become one. And That's a bad idea. The law frowns on that. And he doesn't feel like, he's very skilled as a defense lawyer. But ultimately, Rusty's son, Nat, who's been a figure in previous books, says to Rusty, "Look, I don't think you've ever been as happy, at least as long as I've known you as your child. And I understand your desire to preserve your relationship with B, but you're not going to do it by avoiding what she wants you to do." B says, "You have to be Aaron's lawyer because you know what it's like to be charged with first degree murder and be innocent of that." That brings us back, of course, to the circumstances of the prior novels. And Nat, Rusty's son, says to him, "Look, I understand why this is a crisis in your relationship, and I understand why you're afraid if Aaron is convicted, things are never going to be good again between you and B, because she'll be in a permanent state of mourning. But it seems to me," says the son, "that if you want to try to salvage that relationship, you have to leave her feeling that you've shared her agony and done everything you can for the sake of Aaron's freedom. And if you don't do this, if you don't represent Aaron, whether you feel qualified or not, if you don't do it and he is convicted, that'll probably be curtains because she's always going to feel that there might have been a different outcome if you'd done as she said." And the logic of that ultimately probably becomes the convincing element for Rusty in agreeing to do this. It's Aaron's life is at stake, and his relationship with B is at stake. And he's not sure that Aaron's future is really best pursued in his hands, but he does think he's taking his best shot at preserving this relationship.
Scott Turow is our guest. The name of the new novel is Presumed Guilty. It is published by Grand Central. Do you agree with the idea that it does give a unique perspective of somebody with Rusty's past to be able to defend someone who's accused of murder?
Yeah, and Rusty throughout is comparing his experience to Aaron's and just what it was like to be charged, what it was like to be in court, what it was like to be in jail. Because Aaron has this arrest record as somebody who had his troubles with drugs. First time Rusty and B go to visit Aaron in jail after Aaron's arrest on these murder charges, he realizes how relatively relaxed Aaron appears in contrast to the way Rusty felt the first time he was in the same circumstances. And of course, Aaron has stepped in this river before and finds himself in what he regards to be probably slightly better circumstances than was true when he was jailed previously. But there's a tremendous sadness to the fact that this young man knows what it's like to be incarcerated.
The relationship between the two, I mean, obviously it develops and brings us to the conclusion of the book, but the relationship as it develops from where we join it to the end is really beautiful to watch of how these two men react to each other and ultimately gain a trust and an understanding in one another.
Yeah, I mean, I think for Rusty, Aaron has a tremendous passion for art. He begins to share some of that with Rusty while Aaron is in jail and they're getting ready for Aaron's trial. And it becomes another window into Aaron that Rusty really values because he can see Aaron is a very quiet kind of insular guy, and nobody would ever accuse him of oversharing. But through his artwork and his passion about art and the kinds of works that Aaron prizes, Rusty's able to see what he comes to regard as a pretty substantial young man, a serious, decent young man who's contending with a lot of different stuff, but who's somebody in many ways that Rusty develops tremendous affection for.
And he has a great a great support group. There's his adopted mother, his adopted father, and his grandfather.
Right.
These are people who are on his side, and through hell or high water are going to support this kid.
Right. And he's nobody makes any bones about the fact that Aaron has had what every child should have, which is to say, a loving and supportive family. And you can't think of him as underprivileged in that regard, because he's not. I mean, he's had a roof over his head and three meals a day, and far more important, people who loved him. And Aaron is not without his gratitude for that. He realizes he's fortunate to have had that, even though he realizes as a black person in the United States, he's going to have to find his own way with regard to that part of his experience.
Scott Turow is our guest. The name of the new book is Presumed Guilty. I don't really recall reading this aspect before of a legal case that is actually going really well, right? I mean, for Rusty, the case is going really well. There are some hiccups, there's some questions, there's some things, and there's some pivots and changes. But for the most part, other than just the blanket facts that stare them in the face, this is, by all accounts, a fairly successful run by this attorney.
Yeah, I mean, of course, I speak from experience in defending criminal cases. You're always worried when you think the case is going well, because the natural odds are against you. And so, the last case I tried, which is about a decade ago now, the defendant was ultimately acquitted. I thought it could not have been going better. The state's star witness made a fool of herself on the witness stand. The judge took note of it openly, and yet, right until the moment that our client walked out of the courtroom, I was scared to death for his sake. But and Rusty, who frankly took the case on without much optimism, just because he knew the criminal justice system and realized that Aaron wouldn't have been arrested simply on a hunch, that there had to be a lot of evidence out there that he didn't understand yet. And, he's watched that evidence come together against Aaron. And then, with the assistance of a great investigator, they've begun to chip away at that evidence and develop some pretty significant holes in it. So he's coming home from court every day going, "Well, that actually went pretty well." And yet he's got all this foreboding and a lot of stuff going on with B, his fiance, that they're hitting the rocks pretty soon for reasons that he both expected and never could have guessed at. It is a very mixed world for Rusty, and he's also aware, although this is hardly the most important thing, but the courtroom has been the forum in which he has lived out his responsibilities as an adult citizen, and he's there for the last time. He's sure that he's never going to try another case, and so this is very much a coda for him. You get that push and pull that things are going better than expected in the courtroom and worse than he anticipated in his personal life.
And maybe I'm reading too much into it, but it seems that through this character, and maybe even through you, that there is a great reverence and fascination by the courtroom that comes out through this, as you call it, a coda.
I'm one of those people who I was headed for life as an English professor and made this U-turn and decided to go to law school. And I went for a variety of reasons, but nothing more significant than the intense curiosity I felt about the law and legal questions. And I took my measure well in doing that, because that intense curiosity remains until today. I have one remaining pro bono case, and I was working on it just before you and I got together, Joe. And I can't keep myself. I can't restrain myself from being interested in these things and peeling back the layers of a legal problem. The question that emerges at the end of the novel is, what's that all worth? Yeah, it's like a life being involved professionally with the Rubik's Cube, but what is that really worth besides to the lawyer who's had an engaging pastime? And Rusty's answer, and my own, frankly, is that the law is a highly imperfect instrument because it's executed by human beings, who every single one of them comes with their own flaws. But in terms of its goals, that is to impose a regime of reason on the little bit of life that human beings can actually control, and particularly, to have an orderly process for, these grave questions about whether somebody had done wrong, has done wrong, and whether they should or shouldn't lose their liberty. He thinks that the law, no matter how often it fails, is at least a noble undertaking. It's a noble institution.
I was struck. My nephew is now in a second year of law school in Boston, and but he was required to read 1L, which was your book, nonfiction, the turbulent true story of a first year at Harvard Law School. And I thought that was great. I mean, this is a book that came out in 1977. And that the law school still says, okay, this is important and something that you should, that is universal, that is really interesting, and that I don't know how many professions you could say that about.
Well, 1L and its many successive editions have occasionally had, introductions written by me with the distance of time. And there's no question that legal education has changed a little bit. And if frankly, there are ways in which it's kinder than the experience that I had. But somehow, the terms of both legal education and life in the law are such that most people entering the law experience a certain crisis of identity, that they know that they are being changed by this system of thought that basically says, look, you can do what you want in your personal life, but you're going to have to learn the discipline of this profession, which says that we look at problems through a certain kind of reasoning process. And we compare today's case to yesterday's case, and we don't really allow the claims of emotion, no matter how important they are in our lives. We don't allow the claims of emotion into the courtroom and into the process of legal deliberation to the extent that we can foreclose those things. And every law student probably feels like the person I'm becoming is not the person who I was when I came through the law school doors. And that's inevitably a little bit of a crisis and conflict for every law student. And in trying to explain why 1L is still being read 47 years after it was published, I think that's what accounts for it. Because the particulars, some of them have changed, but that part of the experience won't. And I was certainly somebody in crisis while I was in law school, and I wrote about that.
Earlier, last year, there was the very successful series a presumed innocent on Apple TV. And it strikes me that there are going to be some people who read this novel and reading about Rusty and seeing a picture of Jake Gyllenhaal in their head, and not like I did of having, well, I read the novel first, but still having Harrison Ford in my head. But does that have any impact on what you do at all?
You know, first of all, my world is set in amber in the sense that I have written about this universe of characters who emanate from presumed innocent for many years now. And they've all aged and, you know, Rusty can't step outside that time-space continuum. So he's 75, 76 years old when the novel opens. He's always been 2 years older than me, and he still is. And so, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal, I don't think would have much interest in being cast as a 77-year-old man. Obviously, I wasn't trying to write another book that Jake could star in. Now, many of the same people who were involved in Presumed Innocent have optioned this book, starting with David E. Kelley. But, you know, David's plan is to do this as a standalone work. And what he said the last time I talked to him about this is that his intention to make sure that people don't regard this as part of, is either a sequel to the Harrison Ford movie or the Jake Gyllenhaal series, is his current thought is he's going to change the name of the character so that he can do this as a standalone work about somebody, you know, having, trying hard for a successful third act in life.
The new novel is Presumed Guilty. It is published by Grand Central. Scott Turow, it's always a pleasure to speak to you, and a great pleasure to read this novel. It's so much, so much fun and such a great read. And I thank you very much for spending time with us.
And thank you for the nice words, and more than that, your time, your interest, and, you know, frankly, your preparation. So I appreciate it, Joe, a lot.
Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week. Thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.